the headlines. Israeli settlers attacked a group of Palestinian olive farmers in the occupied West Bank amid an uptick in settler violence in recent months. China says it acknowledges Iran's legitimate position of safeguarding its national interests on the nuclear issue. Also in the headlines, British police declare the fatal stabbing of conservative lawmaker David Ames a terrorist incident. Thanks for joining us. A group of Palestinian olive farmers have been attacked by Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank. Palestinian media say the attack took place near the town of Salfit while farmers were harvesting their olive trees. About 30 settlers from a nearby settlement hurled stones and used pepper spray at the farmers. Four people sustained minor injuries as a result. The media also cited a local farmer as saying that the attackers smashed cars and stole olives. Israeli police say that they have arrested four settlers in connection with the robbery. Settler violence has seen an uptick in recent months. Last month, dozens of Palestinians were injured after settlers attacked a Bedouin village in the southern West Bank. Earlier, we were joined by our Ramallah correspondent, Mona Kandil, who gave us an update on the Israeli settlers' violence against Palestinian farmers.
Well, here in the occupied West Bank, Palestinian families are used to leave to their lands during the olive harvest season. A Palestinian family from the village of Yasuf, near Salfit, northern the occupied West Bank, were in their own land that is unfortunately very close to an area where the illegal settlement of Rahan is built. While they were there, a group of Israeli settlers, over 30 settlers, came out from the illegal settlement of Rahan in the mountain, and they came down to the Yasuf village, attacked this Palestinian families, and tried to order them to leave the area.
The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has held a funeral procession for some of the victims of Thursday's attack on a protest rally in Beirut. Seven people were killed and dozens wounded after protesters came under gunfire and bomb attacks. Lebanese authorities have arrested 19 people in connection with the violence. Mariam Saleh has more from Beirut.
Hezbollah held a funeral procession for three of the seven people who were killed by the far-right Lebanese forces political party led by Samir Jaja. As the families of the victims awaited to bid their loved ones farewell, the slogans were those of grief and pious patience. One of the martyrs, Maryam Farhat, a mother of five, was shot in the head while she was in the comfort of her own home.
God bless her soul. She has made us proud. And may God give us and her children patience. I want to tell those that are sowing sedition in the country not to think about it too hard, because Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah will not allow it. He is the one safeguarding this country.
Hezbollah officials attended the funeral. The highlight of the event was a speech by head of Hezbollah's executive council, Sayyid Hashim Safiyyuddin, who directly accused the Lebanese Forces party of being behind the shootings.
The Lebanese Forces Party's acts are aimed at initiating a new civil war in Lebanon. This is not new for us. In the past, we warned against such plots without naming anyone. All this sectarian incitement and provocation in the media was only to drag people to internal fighting. Today, they have uncovered their true faces. His masters have hurriedly taken this step to drag the country to a civil war.
The master of the killers, he says, is the United States administration.
This is only one episode of the many episodes that are being orchestrated by the United States of America and is funded by some Arab countries. If you go back to the records of the Civil War, they all mention that the U.S. backs and pushes for such acts and Arab states fund it. They are repeating the same episode.
Sayyid Safiyyuddin said Hezbollah will not allow anyone to take Lebanon to the misery that the previous generations lived during the time of the civil war, while also calling for justice for the martyrs. Hezbollah has buried the martyrs who fell in yesterday's shootings, and though the people have chanted that the blood of the innocent will not be in vain, the method of retaliation will not be by taking arms against fellow Lebanese. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Iran slams the European signatories of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal for what it called their inaction to salvage the accord. Iran's foreign minister made the criticism in a phone conversation with his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi. Hossein Amir Abdollahian stressed Tehran's commitment to resuming the Vienna talks aimed at removing the U.S.'s anti-Iran sanctions. Wang Yi, for his part, said all the signatories to the deal, known as the JCPOA, must return to full compliance with their obligations. He said that Beijing acknowledges Tehran's legitimate position of safeguarding its national interests on the nuclear issue. The two diplomats also stressed their country's willingness to promote bilateral ties. That includes a push for greater development of the comprehensive strategic partnership deal that the two sides signed earlier this year. Political commentator Robert Fantina says the three European signatories to the JCPOA have violated the agreements by their continued compliance with Washington's anti-Iran sanctions.
The Iranian foreign minister is correct in saying that the European signatories have not done enough. They also violated the agreement when the United States did, because then President Donald Trump threatened to sanction any European country that continued dealing with Iran. Well, Trump is gone, so those countries, which never should have stopped trading with Iran in the first place, should start again now, and they're not doing so. Their leaders are saying that Iran needs to get back to the table, Iran needs to be compliant. They are not compliant. The U.S. is not compliant. There is no reason for only Iran to comply with this agreement. The reason the Iranian government signed the agreement was for certain benefits, none of which are now being received. So there's no reason for Iran to continue. The JCPOA was essentially nullified when the U.S. withdrew from it. So anything Iran does not violate an agreement that no longer exists.
Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has strongly rejected accusations recently leveled against the Islamic Republic by the president of Azerbaijan, Ilham Aliyev. Saeed Khatibzadeh said such allegations are in line with the interests of the Israeli regime, which seeks to, quote, affect brotherly relations between Iran and Azerbaijan. He said that Iran has had a leading role in fighting drug trafficking and has sacrificed thousands of lives while dealing with this menace. Khatibzadeh noted that relevant international bodies have time and again confirmed Iran's relentless anti-narcotics campaigns. His comments came in reaction to accusations that Aliyev made during a virtual meeting of the Commonwealth of Independent States. He claimed that Armenia, in collusion with Iran, had been using former occupied territories of Azerbaijan to smuggle illicit drugs to Europe for 30 years. British police have declared the fatal stabbing of Conservative Party's lawmaker David Ames a terrorist incident. Metropolitan police say that the early investigation has revealed a potential motivation linked to extremism. The 25-year-old British man of Somali origin was arrested at the crime scene in Lee-on-Sea Town, east of London. Police say that they are not seeking anyone else over the murder. The veteran MP was talking with voters at a church when he was stabbed to death on Friday. Lawmakers are now pressing for tougher security. Home Secretary Priti Patel has ordered police across the country to review security arrangements for all 650 MPs. 69-year-old Ames was the second sitting lawmaker murdered in just over 5 years. Joe Cox from the Labour Party was killed in 2016 while meeting his constituents. Said Purizar is a correspondent joining us from London to tell us more about this. Well, Said, give us some updated information on the stabbing that has taken place.
We were on the scene, Kaveh, yesterday evening, along with many other journalists covering what had happened. The murder, as you reported, happened around noon on Friday as the parliamentarian was meeting with his voters at a church in Lee-on-Sea in Essex, south east England. He walked into the building where he was meeting with the voters and stabbed him multiple times. I understand up to 8 times. Paramedics arrived on the scene trying to save his life, but it was all in vain. He died of his injuries right there inside the church. He entered politics in 1983, was a member of parliament for nearly 40 years, was married, had 5 children, what happened was that, as I said also yesterday, that these meetings are happening as the country emerges from months of lockdown. MPs others as well, trying to meet their constituency members in person so they can have discussions, so they can hear their grievances and work on issues of mutual concern. Tribute trickled in, poured in rather, from across the country, from across the political spectrum, former prime ministers, his peers in parliament, the incumbent members of the government, from the prime minister all the way down to the rest of them. Over the past few hours, the prime minister, the Boris Johnson, as well as the Labour leader, Keir Starmer, and other members of government went to the scene of the incident, to the location to lay wreaths and flowers in memory of this lost, murdered Conservative Party MP, Sir David Amos. He was knighted in 2015 and has been carrying the title of Sir since then. This is the second murder in nearly 5 years. The last one that happened took the life of Joe Cox, a Labour MP known for speaking up for human rights, for the rights of minorities in the UK. She spoke, she gave this impassioned speech inside Parliament on the Syria war. She went to bat for Syrian child refugees, spoke up for Muslims and other minorities in the UK, but was brutally murdered in pretty much the same fashion in her constituency in West Yorkshire in 2016, I believe. And that was not the only one. There were other murders before that, one in 2010 and another one in 2001. And what that is really has led to is it has raised questions around the security arrangements around such meetings, which are referred to as surgeries, the meetings between MPs and their constituents. Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, has promised that she would order an immediate review of security arrangements around such meetings. But then the question that's being asked is how plausible that is to provide security detail to these MPs to make them less vulnerable to attacks of such kind. You're looking at 460 MPs, if I get that number right, and holding meetings like this one on Friday pretty much every weekend. Some are by appointment, some are drop-in, and others are mixed. And to have to provide security for so many of these meetings across the country will really entail a huge police force that will have to be there to provide that kind of security cover. The incident itself, as you said at the top of your story, has now been declared by the police as as act of terrorism carried out apparently by a 25-year-old British national of Somali origin. That's all that has been released so far. I'm sure there will be more detail coming in the coming hours.
Well, the UK broadcaster, funded by the government of the UK, the BBC, has said, quote, the early investigation, Saeed, has revealed a potential motivation linked to Islamist extremism, as it has described it. Of course, there's a problem with the way that they've termed that. But aside from that, do you have any information as to why, first of all, do you have any information on this particular detail that the BBC has said, and also why it would be related to what they have called Islamic extremism?
To be honest, Kava, my guess is as good as yours, but I can only imagine why. If he is indeed a British national of Somali origin, Somalia is a country where more than 99% of the population is Muslim. But then again, you're looking at it from a different angle, and that is the way the media, the mainstream media here, and indeed the mainstream media around the world have been covering issues to do with the Muslim world. So I'm not surprised if they are linking it to this community of more than 1.5 billion people around the world. It's, again, we got to look at it in the context of rising Islamophobia and white supremacism here in the UK and beyond, people who really look for the fall guy, for someone, an scapegoat rather. If it's someone who has committed a murder against an MP, looking around for someone to blame, oh, there is this guy from who happens to be Somalia, so he must have been radicalized because he's a Muslim and he has committed this murder. That's the only explanation I can think of at this point. But again, it's early days, early hours still. I think we'll have to wait and see what kind of detail will come out as the investigation into this murder continues, and whether or not this person indeed was had anything to do with radicalization or Islam altogether, Kevin.
Thank you so much for that. Saeed Pourzadeh, our correspondent from London. Many thanks. On to news from Myanmar, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, has excluded Myanmar's junta chief from the bloc's upcoming summit at the end of October. The group cited rising concerns over the military government's insufficient progress in ending the turmoil in Myanmar. The statement said that the bloc decided to invite a non-political envoy from the country while noting the reservations from the Myanmar representative. A group of other countries, including the U.S., Britain, Canada, and Australia, also voiced their support to the bloc's decision. ASEAN was under international pressure to address the post-coup unrest and crack down a Southeast Asian member. Since the February 1st putsch in Myanmar, many protests in the country have faced a deadly crackdown by the military, attempting to compensate for loss of lives inflicted on an Afghan family. The Pentagon has offered to pay an unspecified amount of money to the family that lost 10 members, including children, in the U.S. drone strike. In a statement, the Pentagon said it was also working with the State Department to help the surviving relatives relocate to the U.S. However, the victim's family had earlier demanded a face-to-face apology in addition to compensation. 10 civilians, including 7 children, were killed in a drone strike in Kabul on August 29th. The U.S. military initially defended the strike, saying that a Daesh suicide bomber was the target. Later, the U.S. Defense Department called the attack a tragic mistake that happened just days before the complete U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight. Making a biodegradable material strong enough to replace plastic is a tough task, but scientists are trying to do just that. We'll now present you an article written by Laura Patterson. The piece is titled "The Future of Plastic Alternatives." It comes from bacteria and goes back to bacteria. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. When people think about plastic waste, they often think of the packaging that swaddles supermarket fruits and vegetables, shiny layers that are stripped away and thrown in the bin as soon as the produce is unloaded at home. It's a wasteful cycle that California-based company, Appeal, says it can help end. The firm has developed an edible, tasteless, and invisible plant-based spray for fruits and vegetables that works as a barrier to keep oxygen out and moisture in, increasing shelf life without the need for single-use plastic. It's currently being sprayed onto cucumbers and avocados at retailers including Walmart. The CEO of Walmart, James Rogers, said, "We're showing that you can actually reimagine a food system that's not built on the foundation of single-use plastic." Appeal, which is valued at $2 billion, is part of a wave of startups and scientific projects racing to develop materials that could help replace traditional single-use plastics. Their production methods and applications vary widely, but their stated aim is the same: to end the scourge of plastic waste. Since the 1950s, the world has produced an estimated 8.3 billion tons of plastics. Nearly two-thirds of this has ended up in landfill sites or leaching into soil, rivers, and oceans. Choking wildlife. Plastics are a driver of the climate crisis. The vast majority are made from fossil fuels, and if global production continues on current trends, plastics may account for about 20% of oil consumption by mid-century. The problem is that fossil-based plastics are not easy to replace. Plastic is a wonder material, cheap to produce, lightweight, and incredibly durable. The latter is a great quality in use, but not when it ends up in a landfill site or the environment. Plastic can take centuries to degrade. Finding a material that is strong but can be essentially self-destruct when needed is incredibly tough. But plenty of scientists and companies are trying to do just that. Bioplastics have emerged as a popular alternative, even if they currently make up less than 1% of the market. Made from biosources such as sugarcane, algae, even banana waste, and shellfish, many pitch themselves as eliminating the need for fossil fuels and also breaking down easily after use. Sarah Kakadelis, a researcher in plastic pollution at Imperial College, University of London, said these green claims do not always stand up to scrutiny. If the raw material is not sourced sustainably, bioplastics could end up increasing deforestation to clear land and competing with food production. They also do not always break down as easily as advertised, sometimes taking years. And others require industrial composting facilities, which can be scarce. Some companies say they have cracked these problems. The Dutch biochemicals company Avantium, which has partnered with brands such as Carlsberg, has developed a 100% plant-based plastic made from sugars that can be used for bottles and firms. The company says its plastic is 100% recyclable, has a significantly lower carbon footprint than fossil-based plastics, and is sourced from sustainably grown plants. If this plastic falls out of the recycling stream, trials have shown that it takes about a year to decompose in an industrial composer. According to initial results from a long-term study with the University of Amsterdam, left in the environment, the plastic starts to degrade after a year. Avantium plans to open its first plant in 2023 in the Netherlands and predicts its packaging will be in supermarkets in just 3 years' time. Other companies are developing plastics that avoid the need for crops altogether. In September, the British-based biotech startup Shellworks launched a plastic made from microbes found in many maritime and soil environments. These feed on carbon sources, building up a fat-like energy storage system. Shellworks co-founder Amir Afshar said, "When his fat is extracted, it behaves exactly like plastic. The difference is, when it returns to nature, the same bacteria see it as food and start to eat it." Afshar said it comes from bacteria and then goes back to bacteria. The company has signed deals with beauty companies to work on products such as tubes, bottles and compacts, which often end up in landfill sites. Co-founder Insia Jafarji said, "When people have finished with Shellworks products, they can be treated like food waste and composted with no special infrastructure needed." Other scientists are trying to turn plastic into a tool for tackling the climate crisis by making plastics from greenhouse gases. Kakadelis said, "One could see in the future capturing carbon dioxide from the air and then using that to produce plastic." Scientists at Rutgers University have developed technology that can turn water and carbon dioxide into precursors for various plastics, which they say could replace PET and polyester fiber, ubiquitous in the fashion industry. About 60% of materials made into clothing is from plastics. Anders Lawson, the chief executive officer of Renew Carbon Dioxide, the startup spun out of Rutgers University research, said the method is essentially replicating nature's process for making oil and gas over millions of years, but doing so in a fraction of a second. The company hopes to harness the CO2 emitted from plastics as they decompose or are incinerated and use it to create new products. Renew Carbon Dioxide is building a pilot plant and expects to reach commercialization in 2025. Increasing consumer pushback on plastics has also led some companies to trial completely different materials. Mars and Unilever are experimenting with paper, which is widely recycled and less harmful than plastics if it ends up in the sea or at a landfill site. This summer, Coca-Cola begins testing a paper bottle in Hungary for one of its drinks, in partnership with Copenhagen-based startup Pabuco, which makes bottles from molded FSC-certified paper pulp. However, these bottles still have a plastic lid and are lined with a recycled PET plastic film which keep the product from leaking or paper fibers from getting in. Pabuco's interim chief executive officer, Gitan Shield, said, "Our ultimate vision is to develop a fully bio-based paper bottle that can also be recyclable in the paper stream." Sander de Vreugde, who leads the new plastics economy initiative at the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, said the big question for these innovations are, where is the material sourced from and where does it end up? For example, paper isn't a sustainable packaging material if it contributes to deforestation or if the paper bottles and sweet wrappers don't make it into the recycling streams. It is also likely to take many years before these materials can scale up enough to make a dent in the 300 million tons of plastics recovered and produced every year. Mark Miodonic, Professor of Materials and Society at University College London, worries about the proliferation of materials being developed without enough thought about how they fit into existing waste systems. He said, "Mostly what we want to do is actually make plastics that are very durable, and we want to keep them in the stream. So we want to recycle." Where he thinks biodegradability and compostability makes sense are products such as caddy liners for food waste bins, tea bags. Why include the plastic that's going to last you 100 years into a tea bag? That's crazy. And hygiene products. Products with very short shelf lives could also suit compostable packaging. London-based Notpla makes plastic replacements from seaweed, a fast-growing carbon sequestering plant which breaks down anywhere within a few weeks. Co-founder Pierre Paslier said, "It's targeted at places where we pick something, we consume it, and it's over within minutes. And that's really where plastic is the worst material because it's going to be around forever." Notpla's edible Uho water bubbles were handed to runners at the 2019 London Marathon. It has also partnered with the delivery service Just Eat to provide compostable condiment sachets that can be put straight into the household food waste bins, and has developed a seaweed coating to replace the plastic lining on cardboard takeaway boxes. Sander de Vreugde said materials innovation is one part of the puzzle, but truly dealing with plastic waste requires a hierarchy of action. Eliminate as much plastic as possible, then use recycled plastic. Finally, where virgin plastic are still required, use renewable feedstocks. He added, "It really needs to be done in that order." Miodonic said scientists, engineers, and companies may be tempted to look at plastic and say, "Let's swap it for another thing, and that's now solved." But the truth is, you have to redesign the whole system if you're going to solve the problem.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Another deadly day for Shia worshippers in Afghanistan. At least 41 people are killed and dozens more injured after three back-to-back explosions hit a mosque in the city of Kandahar. According to a Taliban official, initial information suggests the attack was carried out by a suicide bomber. Taliban have so far failed to stop such attacks after they rose to power a few months ago. At the same time, there are warnings, including one by the Russian President Vladimir Putin, that battle-hardened militants and terrorists with Daesh links are actively entering Afghanistan from Iraq and Syria. In tonight's spotlight, we will discuss the situation in Afghanistan and the growing attacks by Daesh in the war-ravaged country and their implications for Afghanistan and for the region. Stay tuned.
The United States invaded Afghanistan in October 2001 under the pretext of eliminating al-Qaeda terrorists who were being supported by the then Taliban government. Washington spent $2 trillion in maintaining its military presence, but at a heavy human cost. Over 6,000 Americans and more than 100,000 Afghans were killed and millions of others displaced. But the U.S. never achieved its stated goals, rather fled from Afghanistan, leaving the country again in the hands of the Taliban. Now the Taliban are facing a multitude of challenges. One of the main tasks before the group is how to fix the economy, as nearly half of the population is in need of foreign assistance. Humanitarian organizations have already warned that the country is on the brink of collapse. But perhaps a more pressing issue is security. Although Afghanistan has witnessed sectarian violence for decades, deadly incidents have increased since a Daesh terror group emerged in the country at the height of the U.S. military campaign. The Taliban have failed to put an end to such carnages after they rose to power in the war-ravaged country a few months ago. Last Friday, more than 100 worshippers were killed or wounded in a Daesh-claimed attack on a Shia congregation mosque in the northern city of Kunduz. The tragedy struck again on October 15th, this time in Kandahar, where a series of explosions inside a Shia mosque left dozens of worshippers dead. Some analysts believe the United States is trying to sow the seed of sectarian strife, since an unstable Afghanistan serves Washington's interests.
Certainly, there are a number of national interests, both near and afar, that seem almost hell-bent on maintaining a state of insecurity and conflict throughout the Middle East, all the way over, certainly to Afghanistan. Certainly the U.S. Policy going back many years, going back 20 years now at least, has always been to encourage conflict in the region and maintain a state of instability. It suits Israel. It suits a number of other parties.
And it's clear that somebody is trying to provoke a sectarian war between the Shias and the Sunnis. Who's going to benefit from that is, I think, the ultimate question. In Iraq, for example, there's evidence that the British, Americans, and the Israelis were setting off bombs to try to provoke a conflict between the Shias and the Sunnis, so it's easier to control. Perhaps that same tactic is being employed in Afghanistan, where you have, you know, British and American, you know, agents trying to provoke a civil war to pit the Sunni and the Shia and then to help destabilize the country. And out of that, they might be able to get some sort of control.
No matter who are the perpetrators of sectarian violence in Afghanistan, one thing is for certain. The Taliban, as new rulers, need to ensure security for all ethnic and religious groups. Otherwise, neither the international community nor the Afghan people will ever see them fit to govern, and thus will continue losing their credibility.
Joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman, joining us from Washington, D.C. Also on the panel, we have journalist and political commentator Ramiro Funes, joining us from Los Angeles.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Springman in Washington. If you may, please share with us your views on the recent violence that has unfolded in Kandahar.
Well, the recent violence is, of course, deplorable, and it's far more deplorable because it's something that I think you can tie directly to the United States and its left-behind forces. While the American Army may have been formally withdrawn, you still have the Central Intelligence Agency paramilitaries, their own clandestine service people and their agents there. You've got American mercenaries still there, I would believe. So I think what they're trying to do, as some of your commentary came in earlier, is basically to keep Afghanistan totally destabilized and to ensure that the country will never recover from the 20 years of American invasion and occupation. You've got a new government trying to gain control of the country or regain control of the country. And the Taliban are being cut off from foreign aid. The Americans are holding millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, in Afghan funds, as are the Europeans. The United States has directed the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank not to provide any monies whatsoever in any kind of way of supporting the new government in Afghanistan. And as long as you can show that these people are not in control of the country, they cannot control and secure the lives and safety of the inhabitants, they want to show that this is a failure and the Americans need to come back in. The Washington Post for the last several weeks has been running articles about the terrible state of women, the terrible segregation in Afghanistan, the terrible this, the terrible that, as a justification for bringing the Americans back to regain control of the country and supposedly ensure that there will be peace and order again, as if there were during the 20 years of American occupation. Additionally, I would say that they're pushing the idea of the split between the Sunni and the Shi. This may have been an issue 1,000 years ago when Islam developed its two branches, but I think today the Americans and the Europeans and the apartheid entity that calls itself Israel are simply out to show there is a big split in Islam, and that the Sunni are our wonderful friends and the Shi are dangerous, destabilizing forces. And naturally, of course, the Americans are in control of all of this. They created Islamic terrorism with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan 20 years ago, if not longer. And then they created a new variety called Al-Qaeda, which is basically the same crowd with a different name. And now it's Daesh, or Islamic State, or IS, or whatever you want to call it. But in reality, it's the same crowd we created and trained and supported with the help of the Saudis and the Pakistanis in the 1980s and 1990s and so forth.
Mr. Funia, on October 13th, to be precise, Russian President Vladimir Putin warned that militants with Daesh links are actively being drawn from Iraq and Syria into Afghanistan. Putin said, and I quote him, "It's possible that terrorists may try to destabilize the situation in neighboring states," warning that they could even try direct expansion. Who do you think is transferring these terrorists to Afghanistan, and what is the goal behind their deployment?
First of all, I want to offer my condolences to our fallen sisters and brothers in Afghanistan, of course, in Kandahar, but also in Kunduz, where there was also an attack against the Shia mosque. The Muslim community is reeling and is devastated by the impacts of terrorism backed by imperialism and capitalism and Zionism. We have to keep our eyes on the prize. We have to keep in mind who is moving these militants from Syria to Afghanistan, who is funding the rise of ISIS, funding the rise of these radical Wahhabis. It is Israel. It is the United States. It is them, because they are able to use them as proxies for their imperialist regime change against the Islamic Republic of Iran, the People's Republic of China, against the Russian Federation, as Putin was pointing out as well. This is part of the new strategy of regime change, which is chaos, destruction. It used to be that the imperialists would go into a country and have some sort of attempt to rebuild it. That's no longer the case. From destruction, this is accumulation of profits through destruction. And by creating chaos in Afghanistan, by sowing the seeds of division, of backing groups like ISIS-K and attacking Shia Muslims, they're trying to gain this divide and conquer strategy that we've seen carried out in Lebanon, we've seen carried out in Syria, we've seen carried out in Yemen. And at the end of the day, the main enemy of people, the Muslim world, the Islamic world, is not the Shias, it's not the Sunnis, it's not, the main enemy is imperialism. And as long as we keep that in mind, that is the most important. And I think that, as the other guests correctly mentioned, the same forces that backed the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 70s, the same forces that supported al-Nusra and all these other groups in Syria, the so-called pro-democracy protests in Syria, these are all the same NGOs, the same corporations, the same lobbies connected to Israel, the United Kingdom, the United States, that are fomenting this violence and destruction in order for them to justify a new regime change effort, a new platform and base of destabilization in the region. So this is what it all forms part of.
Mr. Springman, I saw you nodding there. You can add anything if you'd like to what our guest Mr. Funes was mentioning. Also, another question. Observers, there are a number of observers, actually, who believe in an existing level of coordination between elements of the United States with Daesh. How do you feel about that notion?
Well, Mr. Funes's remarks were right on the money. As far as your question about U.S. connection with Daesh, I'd say they are very close. The United States created them, as I noted earlier in my book, Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts to Rock the World. I traced the development and the name changes and brand changes, if you will, of Islamic terrorism. And it's basically the Americans and their reprehensible and repulsive allies, such as the apartheid entity, which styles itself Israel, along with Saudi Arabia, a very repulsive and repressive monarchy, are deeply involved in all of this. And they see this as a way of keeping the area destabilized to ensure that the American government can justify its occupation of Syria, its occupation of Iraq, and its constant attacks on Iran in concert with the apartheid entity of Israel. So I think that it is a very conscious thing. It isn't a casual contact the United States has with Daesh or any of these other terrorist organizations like the Khorasan people. It's basically let's keep the destabilization rolling and hope that it spills over into Iran and keeps Iraq and Syria from becoming real independent countries. We did this in Yugoslavia and broke it up into small statelets. The United States has split the north off from Iraq. The United States wants to totally destroy Iran, and the United States wants to keep Afghanistan in pieces. 20 years of occupation and war on a country that where the average wage or income is $2 a day for 90% of the population is a guarantee for destabilization and future problems, and guarantee that the legitimate government of Iran, run by the Taliban, will not be able to take over and control the country and bring peace and order to the place.
Right. Mr. Funes, the same goes. The certain level of collusion for figures from probably the previous government in Afghanistan, the deposed Ashraf Ghani government, of having Daesh being in collusion with them. What do you think about that?
It's no surprise that Ashraf Ghani and his cabinet, backed by the United States, was collaborating with ISIS-K and these other groups. Because at the end of the day, what his administration represented was a kinder and gentler face of U.S. imperialism, of destabilization. His role, he was sort of like the good cop in in the good cop, bad cop scenario. He presented a democratic front, a rebranding, if you will, of Afghanistan, even though these still extremist elements were operating in the country under U.S. occupation, receiving training. The Saudis and the Gulf monarchies have been boosting and expanding their funding for madrasas and other institutions in Afghanistan under this administration. So while he's not openly, his government was not openly supporting ISIS-K and the Wahhabi Daesh elements, at the same time, they were allowing for that to grow, to continue to persist under the country. And I think one of the ways that we can describe it is sort of a controlled demolition, right? He was there allowing all of these groups to expand, bringing the development of Afghanistan to a very minimal low point, so that instead of people having good jobs and education and trade and with other countries, their only option was to get involved in these groups and to become radicalized. So in a way, he kind of provided cover for ISIS-K and other extremist groups in the country and in the region so that they can grow and build dual power, so that for the 20th anniversary of the U.S. invasion occupation, his government would leave, the U.S. would leave, groups like ISIS-K would gain so much power, and then they can once again use that as a justification for invasion.
Mr. Springman, let's focus yet again on the bigger picture and the ripple effects and ramifications for the region. A civil war or any form of civil conflict in Afghanistan would have such dire consequences, as there are so many different ethnic groups. Let's not forget the devastation that that country has endured, having been through decades of war, well over four decades of war. Who would benefit from such instability and violence? And also, what were the repercussions would it have in the broader region and for countries neighboring Afghanistan?
Well, the United States, the Israeli entity, and the European countries, outside of the United States, like Britain, benefit. They can sell weapons. They can political influence. Can ensure that the and remains in pieces and cannot be. There are 14 ethnic groups speaking languages in the country, plus half minority language. The idea of divide and rule empire is exactly this is what the Americans and their they can ensure that if it is in pieces. Forces easily into neighboring territory and ensure that they be able to function.
Some technical difficulties with your connection. I'm going to jump in there. Let's bring a question to Mr. Funes while my guys sort that out for you, Mr. Funes. Let's talk about at this point. You know, we can't talk about Afghanistan without considering the U.S.-led occupation of the country and the tragic events that took place following the pullout of the foreign forces. In your opinion, what did the U.S. achieve during its two decades of presence in Afghanistan?
In the two decades of U.S. occupation in Afghanistan, the big winners were the drug companies. We know, for example, there's a very wealthy, powerful family in the United States named the Sackler family, big supporters of Israel, who are involved in the production and sale of a drug named OxyContin, which in the United States is a massive problem, opioid addiction. In cities across the U.S. where deindustrialization has taken place, you have families who have been impacted by opioid addiction. Drug companies have been making money, tons of profits and money. And it's interesting that this happens just as the U.S. occupies Afghanistan for 20 years. If you look at two charts, one chart, opioid addiction and deaths by year, and also U.S. occupation of Afghanistan, you'll see extreme parallels where opioid companies have raked in millions from the U.S. presence. And some people in mainstream media might critique that, might think that it's crazy, but knowing the history of the U.S. and their involvement in the drug trade, this is definitely something of concern. I think another a big winner in the U.S. occupation was the military-industrial complex. Think about all those weapons, machinery, guns, things that are used for killing and destroying people, produced by Raytheon, General Electric, all these companies that run the U.S. government. They made a killing. They made tons of money because of this occupation, that now all those weapons are in the hands of other people. So they also made a ton of money because there's a whole industry in the United States around perpetuating war. Endless war is profitable for the U.S. imperialists. And so this occupation benefited those major companies.
Let's go back to Mr. Springman for a final comment. Mr. Springman, you can finish up on the comments that you were making about the broader ramifications of destabilization in Afghanistan. Also, if you'd like, you can add to what Mr. Funi has just mentioned about who benefited from the two-decade occupation of Afghanistan. Certainly, the Afghans didn't.
Oh, definitely they did not. Their country, which was never in great shape to begin with, has been totally destroyed. And Mr. Funes' comments on the vast sums of money that flowed into the pockets of the American military contractors is spot on. These are the people that benefited from the war, that will benefit from continuing destabilization in the region. The United States does not want to see Iran function as a healthy, stable government and with benefits for its peoples. The United States doesn't want to see a reunited and operable Iraq after 18 years of occupation. And the United States certainly doesn't want to see Syria functioning as it has previously before the American destruction 10 years ago. So I think that destabilization is to everyone's advantage if you live in the United States or in the NATO countries of Europe. So in the end, the whole benefit of this is more trouble, more problems, more dead people, more destroyed economies, and the total dehousing, deculturalization, and destruction of entire nations.
All right, let's leave it there. That's all the time we have for the show. Allow me to thank my guest, author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman, joining us from Washington, and a special thanks to journalist and political commentator Ramiro Funes, joining us from L.A. Also, thanks to for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now, and see you next time, everybody.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website.